Imagine you woke up this morning and your business just vanished. Welcome to Survival Mode, a podcast that explores how entrepreneurs handle hard decisions in times of crisis. I'm Matthias, and together with Digital Switzerland, we explore what it means to have a hard pivot, go through rapid scaling, or put your startup into hibernation mode. What do you tell your employees if you don't know the answer yourself? Taha, CEO and co-founder of Goodwill, illustrates how he set up his company in a fully remote way, the importance of taking decisions even though you don't have all the answers, and why transparency is key in times of crisis. Goodwill is a leading career development platform for the next generation that prepares over 1.5 million students to enter the professional world. Taha, such a pleasure to have you on the call.
Thank you, Matthias. Great to see you.
So let's jump right into it. How did the whole Corona crisis affect your business and yourself?
Yeah, I think this has been, you know, it's still affecting us as individuals and our society at large. I think on our side, we've got, you know, personally, of course, we're all working from home. Goodwill was a remote first company before Corona. So we had most of our team working remotely across various time zones. The Geneva office, for example, went completely remote just before it was recommended to do so. And for us, that had almost no disruption. That was fine. In terms of our service, it's an online first service. So from a user perspective, from a student perspective, it's working very well. And in fact, we've seen a large uptick over the past weeks as well. However, on the partner side, for sure, we're working, many of our partners and our partnerships are what you would consider to be strategic. They require C-level approval, board-level approval from large organizations. Those organizations, you know, whether it be the CFO, the CEO, the board, for them to make large strategic decisions just becomes exponentially harder while they're dealing with their own crises. So having said that, we're still moving along on various fronts, and that's exciting. What we're seeing is that in our case, the need to support youth and their prospects is probably more important now than it's ever been because of what we're seeing with the economic climate that is to follow the health crisis or to work alongside the health crisis. That economic crisis is really scary. It could be very scary. We still have limited data points, but youth are likely to be affected most, not only psychologically, not only economically, but also psychologically. We did a survey on our community and we found anxiety, stress, fear of their futures, fear of wasting their time, guilt around wasting their time at this period to be really up there in terms of the top sentiments that they're feeling right now. So it's not just about, okay, let's connect you to opportunities, which may not even exist right now. It's also about helping them build their skills, keep them active, keep them positive. And so what we've done, and we've adjusted to this, we've been launching, you know, positivity challenges with our partners. We've been really focusing on developing entrepreneurial skills or promoting entrepreneurship within the community. One way we do that, we're doing this in partnership with government, essentially helping students pitch their ideas, get feedback for their ideas, listen to other ideas directly on our mobile application. This is an example where we think, you know, even if people are not to become entrepreneurs, we did see after the last crisis a boom in entrepreneurship. And we know that whether or not they become entrepreneurs, entrepreneurial thinking is so critical right now. So for us, we've really tried to focus on how can we give our members as much impact, as much value as possible. So over the past weeks, I think the team has really come together. And the team has, for sure, it's a tough time for everyone. I think our society as a whole is going through something that we've never experienced before, at least in our lifetimes or the generation before's lifetimes. But it's really, the team has really come together around the mission and realized, you know, what a role we have to play and has been invigorated by that. So it's been, you know, we are optimists. We're trying to do the best we can in the current situation, but it's definitely, you know, there's definitely huge challenges and we're, you know, there's still a lot that's unknown.
That's incredible. You brought up so many questions. So I'm going to tiptoe a little bit between them. Start with the easiest one. So I guess your company setting up fully remote and globally,
Could you give us some examples how you do it? Because I think you're, if you compare it to the rest of the industry, you're one of the rare examples how that happened. So, I mean, you were prepared. How did that happen, or how did you set that up?
Yeah, so in terms of, in fact, Omar, my co-founder, wrote about this in the Next Web, but what we're doing, we started off with was, there's multiple phases. The easy one is making sure you have the right tools in place to just be able to work remotely. For us, we leverage tools such as, we use Google Hangouts, we use Zoom, we use Slack on a daily basis. We have calendar invites, as you could imagine. Mm-hmm. So that's like the tools bit. Then we have, in terms of actually organizing ourselves in an agile fashion, or just making sure we have daily check-ins across all teams. So we have Scrum meetings across all teams almost on a daily basis. We have our weekly meetings. We have our all hands meetings where the whole team comes together virtually to talk and to make sure that information is being shared. And these are very effective meetings. They're very, very short. They're literally stand-ups that take place, but it keeps everyone on the same page. And it makes sure that if there is something that's blocking, it's known really quickly. The other piece is really making sure that you're empowering your team and really holding them accountable to results. Right. So it's never been about when do you come to work, when do you leave work. Yes, one has to be online at certain times when there are calls scheduled. And our team is really strict about being late on calls. So I get told off sometimes, but we have to be there on time. But apart from that, it's really about, okay, here are our objectives for the next 2 weeks. Here are objectives for the next day sometimes, but here are objectives for the next quarter, year, and then breaking it down into what people might consider to be OKRs or KPIs, and then delivering towards that. And we are all, as long as you give that framework and you allow people to understand that they're being judged on their work and not on the hours or when they're coming in, when they're coming out, it actually leads to a very productive and effective environment. After that, it's at a higher level, of course, purpose and engagement. So especially within this crisis, you see, on our side, it's always been about this, but why am I doing what I'm doing? Especially, I'd say this is across all job types. Obviously, most of our team is on the engineering front, is on the product front, highly educated, very intelligent. We're fortunate enough, but you need to give that purpose. And this is, this I think is not just white collar, but also on the blue collar side, wherever possible, really explaining why am I doing what I'm doing? Why does this matter? So today, it's interesting. The most important members of our society are those who are working, those who are cleaning offices or who are cleaning shops or who are at the shopping markets, or, these are the most valuable members of our society today, our delivery, the people who are delivering food, as we were talking about. This is really what's most important. So I think it's across all sectors, really understanding why am I doing, or all job types or all seniority levels, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why does this matter to the overall goal? And if you're able to clarify that at a high level, give them the tools, give them the framework, give them the also the autonomy. You have to give them that trust. Now you're forced to give them that trust. And I think you're well set up.
Couldn't agree more. There's a great book who describes it, Big Five for Life. They talk exactly about that. So how your purpose, your personal purpose has to be in line with your company purpose you're working for. And then you don't struggle in this trust issue because you're aligned on that side. So I think I couldn't have put it better. Thank you so much for that one. That was an easy one. So let's go to the harder ones now. So member decisions delayed. We talked a little bit about that. And I think it's interesting. So for you, your company was set, but for the people you worked with, they had issues. How do you see them struggle, or why are they struggling?
Yeah, I think on our side, first of all, what was important was to make a decision quickly. I think for us, understanding what we were going to do and be decisive about that was critical as early as possible. I think a lot of companies, small, big, medium, whatever, have teams that are incredibly anxious about their own personal futures, maybe in a way that's never really happened before, because they're seeing their teammates, they're seeing their friends, they're seeing their family members being laid off or being asked to go on unpaid leave or whatever that may be. And you hear what's going on in the news and you see the fears, I mean, beyond just the health risks, which are huge, right? I mean, like, we know people who have suffered from this. I think, you know, in our partners in other countries, Spain, Italy, you know, you see what's happening there, and it's frightening from a real life perspective, not just economic, right? Or not just from a business perspective. And so when you see that, you have an incredible amount of anxiety. So being able to, as an organization, say, this is what's going to happen. You know, we had to do, like, really on a quick turnaround, simulations, scenario planning, the rest of it, and really say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And we have to make that decision quickly. It, you know, we don't have all the data points to make an optimal decision necessarily, but we do have enough to make a decision. And sometimes making a decision is better than not. And, you know, it reduces tension across the board. It gives support to the team. And, you know, there might be mistakes made in terms of decisions, but I really, on our side, we really needed to make decisions quickly. So that was the one piece. On the other side, regarding partners, you know, a lot of our partners are large groups, and you know, they are under tremendous pressure. Stock prices, other crises popping up, and the rest of it. And, you know, most of them have adapted really well. I'd say most of our partners have adapted really well to working remotely, but you do hear examples, and we do have a couple of examples of organizations that are, for them, it would be harder to make a decision in the current climate, whether because they're not able to collaborate effectively, or whether because, you know, there's a crisis popping up every day. And then there's also uncertainty, right? It's hard to make a large investment, long-term investment, strategic investment, when you have so much uncertainty, you know, and that's my take on it. However, I'm sure there are, it would be better to ask them.
I will at some point. No, but it's interesting. So one last question to that. You talked about, you come to a decision, and of course you don't have all the data points, but uncertainty is there and it won't go away. Do you remember when it was that you said, okay, that is what we're going to do. That's how we're going to move forward?
Yeah, definitely. I think, what was it? Now, like almost 10 days ago, I think we said, all right, these are the decisions. So the biggest decision we made was we were going to retain our team. This is what's going to happen. And we said, okay, these are the measures we're going to take to make sure we have the runway to see this through effectively. And we made those decisions, we made those changes, we made those restructuring, but we made sure that we retained our ability to not just survive, but also thrive after this ends, because it will end at some point. And when it does end, we need to be able to adjust to that. And in the meantime, what are the opportunities that we can focus on that can really drive the most value? So whether that be helping youth, maybe via a different type of organization or a different type of entity, whether it be governmental or other. And then on the member side, what are the features that they really need in this time? You know, what is the content that they really need, which is different, you know, there's no doubt about it. I can give some concrete examples, but that's what we really focused on. We made that decision quite quickly. And it was hard, right? Because there's so many different moving pieces. There's so many data points that were still missing. But we made it. We communicated it to the whole team at the same time. And we were super transparent about it all with our team. And we admitted to the points that we just did not know yet. And we continue to do so. But we're going on that journey together. And that's really what we're trying to convey. And conveying to teammates who are on the other side of the world, who are in different socioeconomic, political situations, some a lot worse than what we're experiencing here. It's important to be really, really transparent, in my opinion. And of course, you have to be reassuring, and you have to convey confidence. But I think false confidence, as we see with some of our leaders, global leaders, is not going to cut it today. You know, and you really only have one shot at that. You know, once you lose that credibility towards your team in moments of crisis, because it's easy when things are okay, when things are good. You know, it's easy, right? But it's really, as they say, it's really what happens when things get bad. And I think for us, it was essential to be as clear as we possibly could. And I'm sure we've made mistakes, and I'm sure we'll make mistakes. But you know, at least as long as they understand, as long as the team understands, we're trying to do the best we can. And this is our vision, and this is what we're trying to achieve. Now, here are the things that could hinder us or stop us from achieving that, and here are the unknowns. And I think that gives us the best chance of remaining cohesive. apart from that, we're installing or instilling other new events or virtual events that kind of brings the team closer together. So our teams are definitely chatting more. We have instilling like virtual happy hours, things like that, to just kind of try and act as like, you know, some of our team have said that through this all, Goodwill has been kind of like a safe place for them, right? It's been their healthy distraction, right? That was one of the words that was used by one of our teammates. So we have to work hard to retain that, and they feel safe and they feel comfortable and they feel like they know where they're going. And you know, the world is the way it is. So I can't fake it and say, no, it's totally fine and everything is great and no worries. No, it is what it is. But these are the things that I can tell you that we are committed to. And as a result, hopefully you'll feel like this is a safe place. I said to one of them who was like, you know, if I had told you everything was fine, I would be really worried if I were you, because that's for sure is a lie. And if I were to tell you that everything's going to be okay, and I know it's going to be okay, one of them was asking, how long is this going to last for? You know, like the measures we're taking and the rest. And they're like, Ta, you gave us a range, because I gave a range. And I said, I can't even commit to that range. And they said, but Ta, can you give us a range? Can you give us a more specific date? And I said, if I gave you a more specific date, I'd be lying for sure, because I don't think anyone knows. And that would just devalue my credibility. And that would be just a false hope, because when that day comes, you're going to be like, okay, what about this? And that doesn't work. So I think it's very much the same, you know, within a household. It's, you know, if you have children, it's very much the same. I think if you have an organization, and I assume it's very much the same if you're a leader of a people, right? I think we just have to be as transparent as we can. It's hard, right? Because it's super hard, because it doesn't necessarily quell fears the way we would like to in an absolute way. But I don't think there is a way to quell fears. And I think they understood that, you know, we just have to accept this is the way it is, and we're going to do the best we can.
What do you think are the longer lasting effects of this? What will come out of it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not one normally for predictions, because like most of the things that I assumed would happen have been wrong so far, just generally in terms of the predictions I've made over the past 5 years. But in terms of the economic crisis, I think the numbers are quite scary that we're seeing, you know, in terms of unemployment claims across the board. I mean, it seems like discretionary spend, which makes up much of our economy, is coming to a significant, if not deceleration, halt. And that's obviously going to have a massive impact on the whole economy and on other pieces. I think, what does that mean? It means things are going to slow down. We saw after 2008 that governments have learned how to use quantitative easing and other policies to try and re-stimulate the economy, which they were able to do so with various degrees of success. But they were able to do so. And of course, governments have announced massive policy, you know, almost globally, to be able to reboost and re-stimulate the economy. But this is different. I mean, people are literally not able to go outside. So even if they wanted to consume, you know, there are industries that are just impossible, which make up a big part of our economy, that are just almost at zero. And so what does that mean in terms of employment? It means, of course, less jobs. You know, on our side, we're assuming that until the end of the year, companies are going to be hiring a lot less, if at all. You know, there's going to be restructuring, unfortunately, happening between now and the end of the year, we assume. You know, some companies have moved very quickly, others haven't yet, others haven't figured out the full impact. But it looks like it's very likely, at least, that there's going to be restructuring continuously. And what does that mean, you know, for economies that have very large youth populations? It's incredibly scary. A lot of those, like especially in the global south, a lot of those countries already have structural economic issues in terms of being able to create jobs, in terms of having enough jobs, and a big mismatch in terms of supply and demand, or number of youth and then number of jobs. And this is likely to just affect that in an exponential way. If we take some of the African countries, we look into the Middle East, we look at certain Asian countries as well. This is incredibly scary, because we do know that unemployment and youth inactivity, let's say, has a direct is directly correlated with crime, with instability, with other social problems. We did see, however, you know, after the last crisis, the unemployment crisis in Europe did not necessarily have a I mean, it was hard, but it did lead to some positives. And now on the positive side, we did see a boom in innovation, entrepreneurship that came out. So we hope to see more of that. It will take time, but we hope to see more of that. Obviously, there's no funding now, and there won't be for a while. But when it does come back, it's likely that you've had a lot of talented people thinking about, you know, almost in an existential way about what they can do to solve certain problems. So we might see a boom in terms of new ideas, quality ideas. Having said that, a lot of companies are, small companies are likely to disappear. If you look at runways, there's an interesting survey done by VentureLab in terms of the number of Swiss small companies with, in terms of the runways they have, it's very unlikely for them to raise financing in the next 12 months, unless there's some sort of extraordinary effort done by the state or by the government. You know, we're talking about significant percentage of that group that's worked very hard to get to where it is that is likely to disappear. What does that mean? That means that, you know, the ones that do survive are likely to have potentially even more opportunity. Who knows? So that's on the economic front. I think, you know, I would like to hope that we learn from this. I was saying to someone, you know, if we're only spending on what we need to spend, do we really need to spend so much more? I mean, do we really need to consume as much as we're consuming? We're talking about the economic, the environmental crisis that's looming. On the one hand, what this has taught me and what's a bit sad is that we really had to see this affect us. You know, it wasn't enough to see Italy suffer. We had to see it affect us, like literally our neighborhoods, our neighbors, to be able to really react in a significant way. And that's scary when we think about the environmental crisis, which is, you know, again, an invisible enemy, if we can put it this way. And something that may be affecting, let's say, Bangladeshis or island nations or others. But until it affects us, we're unwilling. It's very hard for us to understand that as a society as a whole. Some obviously did. They were the early adopters, let's say, but then society as a whole, it was scary. Having said that, this did teach us, I hope it did teach us, you know, about, you know, we think we are incredibly powerful and that we can control everything. But, you know, this pandemic has just brought the world to a halt. And I hope this you know, we say for the next one, I hope we're better prepared. I hope we put the resources needed aside to be able to deal with this at a policy level. But also at an individual level, we have a better understanding of the threats we face. And then hopefully this then can be extrapolated to the environmental crisis that's around the corner. So perhaps, I mean, I would like to think, I wish, it's unlikely to be the case, that we say, actually, let's watch out with our consumption. Let's watch out with our travel. Let's watch out with our behaviors that have a negative impact on climate change or on our environment. I say to myself, do I really need to be traveling as much as I was traveling before for work? You know, I think, I was saying I have so much more energy. I was traveling almost on a weekly basis. I was supposed to be in the US on the West Coast two times in the month of March. And you say to yourselves, you know, how much energy and how much time have I gained by not having to do that? And so there, of course, it requires everyone accepting the new rules of the game that we can close a significant deal using Zoom. And we're willing to pursue that on conference calls rather than always having to meet, for example. And yeah, with the discretionary spend, I mean, I hope, you know, and the economy finds a way to work its way around it. We say, actually, maybe we don't need to buy as much as we buy. And maybe we don't need to consume as much as we consume. And maybe we need to consume in a different way. And maybe this pushes us to say, you know, let's prepare for the next health crisis, but let's also prepare for the environmental crisis. That's my hope. Having said that, you know, experts have said, some people might say, you know what, I'm going to make the most out of it before the next one. You only live once, so I'm going to do everything I wanted to do and travel the whole world six times in a year. Fine. And then the others are like, I'm going to buy as much as I can. Or, you know, we're going to re-kick off the economy 10 times stronger than we did before. But when I say re-kick off, in terms of reproducing, you know, going all in on coal, going all in on other, activities that aren't necessarily environmentally optimal. So, you know, I hope it teaches us something. I hope we learn that, you know, when the crisis is here, it's too late and we need to be prepared. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I think over the next months, we're going to learn a lot about us. And I think also the duration of this crisis is going to have an impact. So if it's another week, you know, what are we going to really learn? But if this lasts for a while, you know, is this really going to be a catalyst to change behavior and to change really a generation? A bit like the Great Depression did or World War II did, if you think about generational behaviors or attributes that are attributed to a generation, this could be the one that changes our generation.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's two things that I thought was fascinating. The one thing you said, that we only realized it when it hit us. And it's a big issue with the whole environmental crisis. So far it was away, and we always said, it's not possible to do anything. And now when it struck us or humanity as a whole, we all of a sudden take drastic measures and we see, okay, it could be possible to solve that one as well, most definitely. So I think I'm going to end with this. Thank you so much, Taha. That was amazing. I think I want, in the future, we need a take two on that. It was super inspiring what you said. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Matthias.